Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 119. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're doing horror. I haven't done horror for a while, so it's time I did a bit more horror. In fact, it's been so long that it was in the last podcast that I did horror. I'm not sure why I said that. Anyway, I'm going to do two from two different countries. The first one is the 2012 American horror film, The Cabin in the Woods, starring Chris Hemsworth, Richard Jenkins, and Bradley Whitford. And then we go to Japan from 2006 for the two movie series that are kind of linked up movies. First we have Death Note, and then Death Note, The Last Name. So a bit of horror from both sides of the Pacific. And so sit back, relax, and I will get the contact details out of the way, and we can start talking about creepy shit. Okay, so how is everybody doing? I really haven't done very much during the last week. I did do the radio gig, which was a lot of fun. It was the last one I was doing with Rebecca McLaren, the last of the ABC local radio Northern Territory gigs, because Rebecca's going on maternity leave. And so I'll be doing it with Michaela Simpson from now on. And Michaela's got a very different view on movies than Beck does. So for the last one, we did something very silly. And that was the history of Australian cinema in 25 minutes of radio. I don't know whether we did it justice, but we bit off more than we could chew and chewed like buggery. And we somehow got through it. And it was a nice way to kind of end that period of the radio gig. And I'm going to miss having a chat with Beck. Her viewpoints are different than mine on movies. She really didn't like, for instance, horror movies. And I can respect that. One of the things with doing this kind of stuff, where you're the kind of guest talent that comes in regularly and does things, is that you tailor what you do to an extent to the presenter. It's not something I mind doing. In fact, it stretches me a little bit. Michaela likes a lot of movies that I don't like, for instance, so we're going to have fun with that. And it really is an interesting thing to do. It's an interesting part of my life, which stretches me. It makes me do research. It introduces me to films I might not otherwise watch. And it's just a lot of fun. And I get to go into the city and go into the studio of the national broadcaster, and the security guys know me, and I go up to the booth and I just talk about movies. It's sounds a bit easier than it is, but it still is one of the great joys of my life. So apart from that, not a hell of a lot happening. As I said, in November, Sally and I are going to Tasmania for 2 weeks, so I'm going to try to cram in some episodes I can upload while I'm away so I don't have to try to record on the road. That will be a bit problematic. We're going to be probably staying in a combination of hotels, motels, Airbnbs, and whatever else we can get while we're down there. We'll be catching up with some people, including Tansy, who's been on the podcast. So we definitely want to catch up with Finchie and Tansy, and with one of the two Careys, who's a Patreon supporter of the podcast, whom I've known for a crazily long amount of time, probably well over 30 years I've known Kerry. And it will be nice to catch up with him and his wife Marjorie, and just kind of visiting the Apple Isle. Tasmania's got a horror history too. It had the worst convict settlements in Australia. They committed genocide on the Tasmanian Aboriginals. They committed genocide on the Tasmanian tiger. And there was a lot of cannibalism and buggery going on there. So it's a lovely place to visit. And apart from that, I promised Sal we would go there. She's wanted to go to Tasmania for a holiday for as long as I've known her, and we haven't managed it somehow. We get to take the car ferry across, which is kind of cool. It takes about 10 hours in a car ferry, but we'll do it. And we are going to have a great time with it. There are things like whiskey distilleries in Tasmania, which is always nice. Lots of secondhand shops so we can fill the car up with shit we don't need. And, it'll be a really nice break for us before the usual train wreck that is the holiday season. Apart from that, I've been a good boy. I've been going to the gym regularly and starting to show. My cardio is better. I've got that thing where I used to bend over and then sigh as I bent over. Don't do that anymore. The gut is getting slowly but steadily smaller. And my strength is increasing as well, picking up boxes and moving shit around the house is a lot easier than it was when I wasn't doing that. So Highly recommend getting a gym, but I know it's not for everybody. So I did have some time on my hands, as you might understand, being either unemployed or retired. I still haven't decided entirely what. So I've been watching a few things. I did pick up a movie called Sol Madrid, which is a kind of drug, crime, gangster, mafia movie from the 1960s. Got an interesting cast, but ultimately it doesn't really work. The good guy is played by David McCallum, who was at the time working on The Man from U.N.C.L.E. The love interest, which is a very ambiguous love interest, was played by Stella Stevens. The bad guys are played by people like Rip Torn, Telly Savalas, Ricardo Montalban. And it's kind of almost works. Originally in the production, they were going to have the Rip Torn character played by John Cassavetes, but he dropped out of it. Nonetheless, it kind of works. It's set in Mexico, and there's a lot of location shooting in Acapulco and I think Tijuana, though I'm not entirely sure of that. But it's very much a kind of MGM programmer from the 1960s. And David McCallum in a tough guy role just doesn't work. He doesn't have the kind of gravitas to carry off that kind of role. But nonetheless, it's got a really nice Lalo Schifrin soundtrack. And I picked it up fairly cheaply, so it really wasn't an issue for me to watch that one. Just for completion's sake, I did watch the Netflix version of Death Note, one of the movies I'm going to talk about on this podcast, from 2017. It doesn't work. I watched the original two movies, Death Note and Death Note, The Last Name. And then I watched the Netflix American version of it, where the characters are whitewashed and it's taken out of its social and ethnic context. And it doesn't work. They got Willem Dafoe to do the voice of the demon in it, but for me, having seen the other two, it's a much lesser product. They went with the gore factor, so there's a lot of splatter and decapitations and all sorts of other things like that, which aren't in the 2006 versions. But it really doesn't have the tension that the less gory versions have, which is kind of interesting. So I watched that, but it did not impress me at all. I did also watch Edgar Wright's Baby Driver, which is kind of cool because all of the action sequences are choreographed to songs, and the soundtrack to Baby Driver is really, really cool. It's got some innovative choices, and visually the movie's really interesting, but ultimately it's a little bit kind of meh in some ways. It does have some interesting character actors. It's got Jamie Foxx, it's got Kevin Spacey in it, John Hamm playing a bad guy. But it just, the visually it's great. Just looking at it is great. And the fact that the main protagonist uses iPods is kind of cool because currently on my desk I've got two iPods. But nonetheless, it really doesn't work. The depth of characters and the lead character and his love interest, Deborah, really doesn't kind of work. There's not a fantastic chemistry between them, and the guy who plays the titular character, an actor called Ansel Elgort, which sounds like an anagram of something else, but it isn't, it's kind of okay, but he doesn't really have quite that level of charisma yet to carry a film the way that he's asked to do. That isn't to say he's not going to get there, and in a few years he may well do it. But at this stage, he's just kind of slightly under the line for it, which a little bit disappointing. But it just occurred to me that I keep forgetting this. And I'm going to drop a name here, so bear with me. Kevin Spacey is quite good in it. And I just remembered that I had met in 1988, I met Kevin Spacey. And that's kind of interesting, almost 20 years ago. I met him at a press conference he did with a really small audience. You've got to remember, this is before he won any Oscars and things like that. But Kevin Spacey did a press conference with like 10 people there for a movie he was directing called Albino Alligator, which I really should rewatch at some stage. But he did talk about cinema in an interesting way. Very intelligent guy. Enormous fucking head. I'm not sure whether I've said it on a podcast before, but Kevin Spacey has a head that looks like someone put a bicycle pump in his ear and just gave it a few extra pumps. But nonetheless, a fantastic actor, really intelligent guy, and it's always fun to watch him in movies. So I watched Baby Driver. The other things I watched, I found an Australian film which I hadn't known about from 1956 or 1957, produced and starring Chips Rafferty and set in the highlands of Papua New Guinea. At the time, Australia administered New Guinea, at least the east side of it. The west side was then owned by the Dutch and the Indonesians took it over, which is a whole new horror story. But it's about a guy and, well, a team of people, really, who are sent in to build a landing strip in a remote part of New Guinea for an oil prospecting business because an old prospector guy played by an actor called Reg Lai has found oil there. And, of course, being the rapacious people that 1950s Australians were, they want to go in and get the oil. So it was filmed on location in the highlands of New Guinea and has tons of tribal people in there. They're treated with a lot more respect than a lot of movies at the time showed them. And there are all these little telling details about how people live in the highlands of New Guinea at the time that was really interesting, like how witch doctors get snakes to bite people and how and the belief systems of the New Guinea highlanders. So there's a lot of interesting detail in there, filmed in colour but not widescreen. It was written by Chips Rafferty and his off-frequent collaborator, Lee Robinson. But it really is a different kind of action film, and it's really great to see New Guinea highland tribes people, hundreds and hundreds of them, all armed with bows and arrows and spears. It's quite an imposing bit. It has a documentary feel to it for a lot of the film. It's one of the movies that the Australian Film and Sound Archive have preserved because it's deemed as culturally important. They don't get anywhere near as much money as they need to on the at the archive. I actually went there once back in the 90s. Had a friend that worked there, so I got to go through the stacks. And the amount of material preserved that the Australian Film and Sound Archive has is mind-boggling. They have enormous aluminium-etched records preserving a whole bunch of historical stuff, which is about, was then going to be transcribed into audio in a more convenient medium. But, yeah, I really have a lot of respect for the National Australian Film and Sound Archive. And they're putting a lot of stuff up on YouTube at the moment. A lot of documentary stuff from the past about Australia is going up on YouTube for free, of course. And it's really nice to see that kind of stuff. I've been kind of browsing through the documentaries they did about different cities in Australia in the 50s and 60s. And there's some really interesting ways in which life is worse in those days. But conversely, a lot of ways in which life was better, which is kind of interesting. There was a kinder attitude to a lot of things than there is today. Though, of course, there were a lot of things that were a lot worse as well. The other thing I watched was the first in Ivan Tor's science fiction trilogy from the 1950s, the OSI, Office of Scientific Investigation movies, and that's The Magnetic Monster with Richard Carlson in it, about a scientist who develops a new element which basically creates enormous magnetic fields and is causing trouble. There's a lot of kind of 1950s diesel punky science in it. It's a lot of fun and very entertaining. I enjoyed rewatching it. It doesn't take too long to go through. And, yeah, I really should do. I've already done GOG, the third in the trilogy, for Martian Drive-In Podcast. But I really should do the first and the second one, Magnetic Monster and Ride It to the Stars, which are kind of cool and interesting in a retro scientific sort of way. There are no monsters in these, even though it does say The Magnetic Monster. It's purely a science-based monster in a sense and kind of cool. And they also use some stock footage from a 1930 German science fiction movie called Gold, which has some enormous machinery in it that they needed to tell this story. And Gold was made by UFA, the German film company who did things like Metropolis and the cabinet of Dr. Caligari. So there's an interesting disconnect between the footage filmed in the 50s and the footage filmed in 1930 on different continents. So the Magnetic Monster was a bit of fun to watch. It's always nice to take a look at people with great big clacking computers and great big dials and gauges and things like that doing scientific stuff and talking about radiation leaks as if they were something fairly trivial. But anyway, that's about it for what I've been watching. Apart from the fact, I should mention these. I have watched the first two episodes of Star Trek Discovery, which has the best acronym ever. And I'm still withholding judgment about it. There are potentials there, but I think it's a little bit of a clunky start. But then if you take a look at something like Encounter at Farpoint, the Star Trek The Next Generation first episode, it holds up well compared to that, which was a real dog. I like the fact that they've got female protagonists in it, and they were very empowered and flawed people as well, which is kind of cool. And I like the look of it. I like the look of the Klingons, even though the mouth prostheses make it hard for the actors to talk. And as somebody has mentioned on Facebook, there's this thing going in science fiction television series at the moment. The Orville does it, and Star Trek Destiny does it as well, where actors of color are put under heavy prosthetic makeup. There are a lot of the Klingons are black actors in Star Trek Destiny, and some of the aliens in the Orville are actors of color who are covered in heavy makeup, which is something that maybe they should keep an eye on. But the other thing I watched was the first two episodes of Marvel's The Inhumans, and this one I'm less optimistic about. There's some fairly bad acting in it, and I think the pacing is very much off. They front dump a whole bunch of exposition at the start of it, but it's still got potential to pick up its game and give us something interesting to watch. The next couple of episodes will probably tell us whether that's going to happen or not. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to do these in reverse chronological order. And the first thing I'm going to take a look at is the 2012, The Cabin in the Woods.
Everybody ready? Let's go on the road!
Acquiring targets.
We're looking for
Tillerman Road.
I'll get you there. Getting back. That's your concern.
This is awesome.
No way.
Lock them in.
The lambs have come to the killing floor.
Something weird is going on.
What is that thing?
Somebody sent those things here to get us.
We gotta get out of here.
Oh my God, what is this place?
Cabin in the woods.
I think I can get it to go down.
Do we want to go down?
Rated R, in theaters April 13th.
People have been telling me for years to watch The Cabin in the Woods, and I haven't until recently. Like the Death Note stuff, it's actually one that Sally recommended to me. We picked up a copy of it on Blu-ray for like $10 with 20% off, which is okay, and then I watched it last week and went, yep, okay, this is a podcast movie. I'm going to do it on the podcast. And it is kind of cool. It was written by Drew Goddard, who'd started out doing episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and had written and produced a number of other things, including he was a writer on World War Z. He was a producer on the Netflix series Daredevil and the Defenders. So, and he was a producer on The Martian. Long-time collaborator with Joss Whedon, who we now know is fairly problematic because of his personal life. But leaving that aside, this movie really does rock. It works on a number of different levels. It's got two or three layers of reveal, which are very, very cool and really work much better than I expected them to. And I picked one of the two levels of reveal, but not the ultimate one, which I'm not going to spoil in this review because you've got to see it to appreciate it fully. The story is fairly simple. It starts out in an underground bunker where a couple of scientists/technician kind of guys are taking bets on how things are going to go with a certain project they've got. They discuss a mysterious operation. It's an international thing. There are similar operations being done in Stockholm in Sweden, and they talk about the Japanese having a hit on them. So they really give us a bit of mystery to start with, which is kind of interesting. We want to know more about it because the two guys are played by two fine actors, Bradley Whitfield from The West Wing and Richard Jenkins from any number of different things. Sorry, Bradley Whitford. I said Whitfield. It's Whitford. I've really got to keep that right. And they're planning a project. Now, there are five college students who are the focus of this project. Dana, Holden, Marty, Jules, and Kurt, played by Chris Hemsworth, Kristen Connolly, Anna Hutchison, Fran, Jesse Williams. They're planning, basically the setup for any number of different horror movies, which is they're going to spend the weekend in a deserted cabin in a forest, hanging out, smoking dope, getting drunk, getting laid, doing all the things that one does when one is young and has access to a cabin. We've all done it, except it didn't end quite in the manner of this one. The cabin is quite creepy, and on the way there, they stop off and get gasoline from a very creepy guy called Mordecai, who is played by an actor called Tim Dazan, and he is fantastic. He's like somebody buried Van Heflin and dug him up again and resurrected him. That's how Tim Dazan plays the character. He's scary. He's a scary country backwards kind of thing, kind of person. And it does set things up nicely. Of course, we've got the Hemsworth in this one. So this is still in a fairly early role for him around the time that he got picked up for playing Thor. And just around the same time as well that he played Captain Kirk's father in the first of J.J. Abrams' reboots of Star Trek. And apparently he's going to be in the next one when they finally get around to making it. So we've got that set up there. Chris Hemsworth and his girlfriend playing slap and tickle and having a bit of fun. You've got Fran Kranz playing Marty the Doper. Jesse Williams is interested in one of the other girls, with the other girl in the piece. And, so basically it's got the same setup as any number of horror movies from about mid-1970s onwards. The only thing is that they're being manipulated by these mysterious scientists in this lab to do something. They talk about changing pheromone levels to make some of the people hornier. They've got a number of different ways of manipulating, controlling them. They've got cameras all over the cabin and outside the cabin as well. And the setup is supposed to lead us to believe that they're doing a really sick reality TV show for sick bastards around the world. It turns out that's not the case, but it plays a lot like that. The young people then go into the basement where there are every fucking creepy thing you've ever seen in a horror movie. There's a fortune-telling machine. There are books. There's a mechanical puzzle sphere. There are any number of different tropes from any number of different horror movies down there. And the scientists and technicians keep talking about how they're not supposed to control the choices that these young people make when they're in the basement. We only later learn the reason why they are encouraged to make choices and what happens if they choose particular objects. It turns out they pick out a manky old diary which tells the horrible story of a young girl and her cannibalistic, nasty family from about 100 years ago. That then triggers events, and a zombie killer hillbilly cannibal family come up out of the dirt and start attacking the cabin. The people manipulating this have ways of influencing the actors in the play, in a sense. They increase pheromone levels and hormones so that Chris Hemsworth and his girlfriend end up doing the dirty boogie on the ground outside the cabin, and things don't end well. There's a lot of gore, but it's kind of the kind of gore where you can laugh nervously while you see it. It isn't full-on torture porn gore, but it really does give us the sense that there's a lot at stake here. And in fact, there's a lot more at stake as time goes on and we find out the true nature of what's going on. And when some of the protagonists end up finding their way down into the secret layers, levels between beneath the cabin, where all of these scientists and technicians are doing their job, we find out that there's a lot more down there than we expect. And the reasons why those things are down there is pretty fucking cool and mind-blowingly cool, in fact. There are a lot of good actors in here. We get Amy Acker playing one of the technicians. We get Sigourney Weaver turning up as the director of the piece, the director of the center where all of this is going on. We find that in the down below areas, they're taking bets on what monsters the people upstairs actually choose when they make their choice in the basement. And there's a lot of betting going on. And there's a lot of sickness to what the people down below are doing. But we kind of get an understanding of why they're doing it. Needless to say, things don't end well for the people downstairs when Dana and Marty, the two survivors of the piece, and it's not too much of a spoiler to say that, end up going down and unleashing hell in an almost literal sense. There's a scene where they kind of get into a control booth and flip all the switches, which has got to be seen to be believed. What happens when that occurs is mind-blowing and very cool, and it's one of those scenes that you want to take slow-mo if you possibly can, because you will miss something if you don't. I really don't want to do too many spoilers on this, because the good part about it is the reveal, and the reveal of the different layers of plot, where we're led to believe that one thing's happening, but it turns out that's not quite what's happening. We find out that these killer hillbillies are genuine monsters. They're not just robots that somebody's put up in a sick kind of fucked up Westworld scenario, but they are genuine monsters and really sick and nasty because of that. We find out that if you're in a horror movie situation, smoking dope is a good thing, particularly if somebody's trying to manipulate you chemically, because the dope stops that manipulation pretty much in its tracks. And this one is very much a movie for horror fans. If you like horror movies, even if you go back as far as Universal horror movies from the 1930s, and you're a fan of those, then you're going to get a kick from this film. It really does do a lot with a production budget of only $30 million, so it wasn't necessarily at the top end of things. But it really does give you full value, and if you're a horror movie fan, in the classic sense, not of slashers or even of classic ones, going back as far as H.P. Lovecraft, if you're a fan of Lovecraft, you're going to get a lot out of this particular movie as well. And it really does give us a terrific roller coaster ride as an audience. Sally and I watched it, and it was her second time for watching it, and she still liked it a lot. She really had a great time. It does end on a fantastic image, this movie. And the choices made by the protagonists, we're kind of led towards those choices as the movie progresses. And I can't really knock the validity of the choices made by Dana and Marty at the end of the film, played by Kristen Connolly and Fran Kranz, which is a hard word to say, hard name to say, Fran Kranz. But it really does work. I like movies like this that are smart in their plotting and give you a number of different layers when you think you know what's going on, they'll just mention something casually. Bradley Whitford or Richard Jenkins will mention something and you go, hang on, that isn't quite what I thought was happening. So there are beautiful reveals in this film, and I really like movies with beautiful reveals. If you watch enough films, as indeed I do, and suddenly a movie comes out and blindsides you, it's something that some people might be pissed off with, and you can find reasons not to like it. But for me, it really does work. It's like when I'm watching a magician work. Now, once you watch a number of magicians work, and you watch a number of YouTube videos about stage magic and close-up magic and things like that, you know how things operate to a certain extent. But there are times when they blindside you and you think it's going to go one way and it goes another, and something surprising and pretty cool happens during that process. And this movie acts in many, many ways like a magic trick. You think you know that there's going to be a rabbit pulled out of the hat, but that's not what happens. There is a rabbit involved somewhere, but you don't. It's not in any way that you can possibly predict. And the people making the trick are way ahead of you as an audience member. And that's kind of cool. And I've got a lot of respect for that. It's not something that ever pisses me off, unless it's done badly, in which case it pisses me off. It's when people assume that I'm dumber than I am in movies as well. That is another thing that pisses me off. But in this case, it's a smart, funny, terrific, transgressive movie. It doesn't end the way horror movies normally do, and it is a lot of fun. Now, Joss Whedon co-wrote the script with the screenwriter for Cloverfield, Drew Goddard, who ultimately directed the film. And both of those things really work well for it. Goddard's direction, even though it's his first directorial debut, it does work kind of well, and it really does give us a love for what's being done. This film really does deliver, and if you haven't seen The Cabin in the Woods, definitely do so. I hope I haven't spoiled too much for it, because I don't want that. And it's the kind of movie that you can very, very easily fuck up for people if you're a little clumsy with it. Hopefully I haven't. But all I can say is, with the setup, go for the ride. It really will pay dividends if you do that. So anyway, I'm going to take another break now. And when I get back, we're going across the Pacific to Japan for a demon-haunted movie, Death Note, and Death Note, The Last Name.
Checkmate. A battle of wits. The suspense builds from the previous Death Note, as all questions are answered in the much-anticipated sequel.
I'll be your eyes from now on.
He's out cold!
You're murdering!
Have some compassion! Believe me, I'm not Kira!
The emergence of a second Kira who possesses the eyes of the Shinigami, and a third Kira. Who will win?
The last mistake I'll ever make.
Who will survive? Death Note, The Last Name.
Okay, let's move on to Death Note and Death Note, The Last Name, because I see them as one long film, even though they were both produced in 2006 and released in the cinemas in that 12-month period. But they form a single story with a satisfying ending and some very cool stuff in them. The story is fairly simple. Light Yagami, a Japanese college student whose life undergoes a drastic change when he discovers a mysterious notebook known as a Death Note lying on the ground. The Death Note's instructions claim that if a person's name is written within, while the person writing it pictures that other person's face, that person will die. Light is initially skeptical of the Death Note's authenticity, but after experimenting with it, he realizes that it is real. I'm reading this off Wikipedia, by the way. After meeting with the previous owner of the Death Note, a Shiganami named Ryuk, Light seeks to become a god of the new world by passing his judgment on those he deems to be evil or who get in his way. He begins using the Death Note to kill scores of criminals and becoming a notorious serial killer known as Kira. As Kira continues, some in Japanese society come to see him as a righteous figure. Interpol lodges an investigation into the murders, which take place all around the world without any fruitful lead. The case eventually attracts the attention of L, a reclusive and world-famous detective. Working with Interpol and the Japanese police, L manages to confront Light through a television broadcast and demonstrates his deductive skills, correctly surmising that Light lives in the Kanto region of Japan and that he can kill without lifting a finger. The race begins between L and Light to discover each other's identity, and a game of cat and mouse ensues between the two geniuses. So the first question that comes up is, what's a Shinigami? It's a god of death or a death spirit. a Buddhist concept. They, according to Wikipedia, they are gods or supernatural spirits that invite humans toward death and can be seen to be present or interpreted to be present in certain aspects of Japanese religion and culture. Shinigami have been described as monsters and helpers, creatures of darkness and fallen angels. Many cultures describe Shinigami as death itself. And the Ryok, the Shinigami we see first in the first Death Note movie, is computer generated. They used a guy in a leotard with dots all over him in the manner of Andy Serkis. And the CG isn't fantastic. I'll be honest with you about that. Even for 2006, it's not terrific, but it works. And that's the weird thing about it. The CG and Ryok works. Ryok's creepy character. He's got wings. He's kind of hunched over and creepy looking with spiky black hair. And he's very fond of apples. And Light keeps him supplied with apples. And he'll eat apples till the cows come home. And he has his own agenda, and he realizes he's bored and he's playing a game with these human beings, and he really does it well. Now, the cast in this is really cool as well. Playing Light is a character actor called Tatsuya Fujiwara, who played in one of the classics of Japanese kind of horror slash and nasty cinema, Battle Royale and Battle Royale 2. And he looks like an anime character. He's really got, he's got a sharp nose and kind of very cute features and perfectly styled hair. So he definitely comes across as a translation from the original anime. And this was based on an anime originally and a manga before that. But it really does work. Now, playing L, which is a much more difficult role to play, is an actor called Kenichi Matsuyama. And L is a fantastic character. He's a skinny, geeky otaku. He's got pale skin and shaggy black hair. He always wears loose clothing and basically tracksuit pants and a sweater. And he's constantly snacking on desserts. He'll eat chocolate. He'll eat all sorts of other things. We never see him not slowly binge eating desserts. And it gives him a kind of creepiness. And there is a kind of implication that he may be somewhere on the autism spectrum. But he is brilliant, and he's got a wonderful way of revealing information that he has ascertained, mostly using research, but also using his fantastic intuition. He's kind of Sherlock Holmes as an otaku. If you don't know what an otaku is, you can Google it. It's a Japanese nerd, in a sense. And the difference between Light, who's attractive to girls and smart and cocky. His father is the chief of police who ends up helping to run the search for the mysterious Kira. And he's played by an actor called Takeshi Kaga, who's got a fantastic gravitas and who played the chairman in the original TV series of Iron Chef, which is kind of cool. And he definitely brings a kind of, and I don't like comparing actors from other cultures with each other because I think it's a simplistic way of looking at things. But he does have a little bit of a Toshiro Mifune vibe about him. And he's an honorable cop. Doesn't particularly like working with L because L's a freak and not part of the chain of command that Mr. Yagami is used to. But it kind of works. In fact, it really does work. There are a number of other people that get involved and a couple of different love interests for Light in the progress of the two films, including Misa Amane, who is a TV star who has her own cooking show on television, who ends up getting her own Death Note, from her own Shinigami called Rem, who's kind of white and seems to be constructed out of bones. And he really does bring out the worst in Misa. In some ways, Misa Amane is at least as bad as Light is. Light is a total sociopath. He's Patrick Bateman with a book, in a sense. And he really does have a creepiness about him, and he's willing to sacrifice anyone and anything in order not to be shown to be killer and to continue his agenda of killing people that he thinks deserve to die, including at one stage a whole bunch of FBI agents whose names he finds. And that's the limitation of the Death Note. You've got to be able to picture the person's face, and you've got to see, have their real name. And this is Light's problem with L, because L wears a mask on his face for the start of the thing, so Light can't get a good picture of him. And his name is never revealed. His real name is never revealed. In fact, he may not even have a real name due to his background. So these two antagonists play off against each other through the two movies. One using the Death Note to dead end lines of investigation for the other, and L using the vast resources that he's given to try to find who actually Killer is, even though he does suspect he's Light. And Light uses a whole bunch of different techniques, including the rules of the Death Book, Death Note, which are quite complicated. In the American version, there are about 30 different rules. But I'm going to open up my DVD box set of the two Death Note movies, because it's got the original Death Note rules in it. And I'll go through some of, not all of them, for you. It says, Death Note, how to use it. 1. The human whose name is written in this note shall die. This note will not take effect unless the writer has the person's face in their mind when writing his or her name. Therefore, people sharing the same name will not be affected. If the cause of death is written within 40 seconds of writing the person's name, it will happen. If the cause of death is not specified, the person will simply die of a heart attack. And we see a lot of people dying of heart attacks in these movies. After writing the cause of death details, the death should be written. After writing the cause of death, details of the death should be written in the next 6 minutes and 40 seconds. How to use it. 2. This note shall become the property of the human world once it touches the ground it arrives at in the human world. The owner of this note can recognize the image and voice of its original owner, the god of death, so people can see Ryuk and Rem if they touch the death note. The human who uses this note can't go to heaven or hell, so basically they die and nothing happens. How to use it. 3. If the time of death is written 40 seconds after writing the cause of death as a heart attack, the time of death can be manipulated and the time can go into effect 4 seconds after writing the name. The human who touches the death note can recognize the image and voice of its original owner, a god of death, even if the human is not the owner of that note. So there are all these different rules in there, including one rule which enables an out for the owner of the death note, which enables, if the death note is passed to somebody else, the original owner forgets that they were ever the owner of the death note and everything to do with that. So amnesia to order can be done to manipulate things. And there is a time when Light and also Missa are caught by the police and held in custody in some pretty torturous kind of situations for a prolonged period of time. But both of them have that amnesia, and so they don't know that they're guilty of the crime. And this is all done, planned ahead by Light, so that he can misdirect things and raise doubt in L's mind that Light is actually the owner of the Death Note and he's a killer. And the beautiful thing about this over the two movies is there is that back and forth and the unexpected things happening. And just when you think one of the people is behind the game, they do a reveal where either L has the upper hand or Light has the upper hand. And there's a constant antagonism between these two incredibly intelligent, incredibly smart guys, who one of whom is trying to protect people and the other of whom is trying to kill them because he's decided that he's the best person in the world to determine who lives and who dies and why. And I think the choice made here, which is incredibly valid to me, is that most of the deaths are by heart attack. So we don't have the kind of gore factor as a distraction from the plot, whereas the American Netflix Death Note uses that, and it actually weakens the interaction between Light and L. And I think that was a mistake. But in the Japanese version, most of the things happen by heart attack, except when it's convenient for them not to. And it never really gets into a lot of gore. But over the period of the two movies, there's this really interesting tension built up. And the fact that this is a world-changing event, because these deaths appear all over the world. And sometimes they're dictators, and sometimes they're other people. Sometimes they're criminals around the world, which makes things kind of global and gives us a perspective on how Light sees himself as kind of a global eradicator of bad people and how dangerous that makes him and how it encourages the worst aspects of his character over the period of the two movies. And these aren't just the only two movies in the Death Note, by the way. You've got the American one, of course. But in 2008, there was a spin-off movie called L Changed the World, where it shows a period after the end of the second Death Note movie. And I'm not going to go into too spoilery stuff, but so over a short period of time after that, where L has to catch a bioterrorist group. It has a very short timeline in which to do so. So I really want to try to find a copy of that. And let's go back to my disambiguation page. There was a live-action TV series in 2015. And in 2016, there was an anime sequel called Death Note Light Up the New World. And the TV series... let's have a look here. I'm just trying to read through the details on this because I wasn't aware of it until a couple of minutes ago. I think it may possibly be an anime, though I'm not entirely sure of that because the information I've got isn't precise about it. Now, let me just go here and see what we've got. Yeah, it's definitely, is it anime? No, it's actually live action. So, incredibly popular franchise and incredibly lucrative franchise in Japan. And Sal and I were wandering through Play, which is a terrific DVD and Blu-ray shop in Melbourne. And she decided she wanted to pick up a copy of this because she'd seen the American one. And we watched them both, and they work really, really well for a number of reasons. They're very tightly plotted. I don't think that the budgets were incredibly high, and on those kind of slightly limited budgets, I know that the director of the two films, who is a guy called, he said, looking this up quickly and trying not to sound like he doesn't know what the fuck is happening here, a guy called Shusuke Kaneko, who... was an interesting guy. He was a big fan of Star Trek, Lost in Space, and The Outer Limits, which is kind of cool. Let's see what he directed. He directed Godzilla, Mothra, and King Ghidorah, Giant Monsters All Out Attack in 2001. He's done a few other things. He directed Gamera, Guardian of the Universe, so he mostly started out doing kaiju movies and kind of young teenage pieces of froth like Summer Vacation 1999, and Hong Kong Paradise in the late 80s and early 1990s. So the direction is really tight in this, and I think that the script is the thing that really makes this work, because like The Cabin in the Woods in some ways, there's a bit of misdirection here. We think we know what's going to happen next, and then it doesn't. And that continues all the way through both of these films. And that's kind of cool. Part of it is my cultural expectations. I expect the father, for instance, to act slightly differently than he does because of my own cultural preconceptions. And he does things in his own way and by his own code of honour. And L as well doesn't act the way we expect him to, because he's a random kind of person anyway, sitting kind of hunched up on chairs with his feet tucked up underneath him, munching on chocolates with kind of dainty fingers, and beating everybody else in the room. He's the smartest guy in the room, though he looks like he's the dumbest. Now, really nice invention of character there. Light less so. Light's more a standard sociopath in some ways. But L is a really interesting invention. An otaku as Sherlock Holmes. And if Sherlock Holmes was Japanese, he'd be an otaku as well. But just to kind of finalize this, if you're in Australia, East and I put out the double set of these movies, which Sal and I picked up quite cheaply. There's even a really nice little booklet that comes along with them with details of the actors. There are interviews with the director in English and a lot of stuff about the different characters, including Ryok and Rem and L's kind of majordomo character, Watari, played by Shunji Fujimura, who's a really interesting character in his own right, an older gentleman who acts almost like a butler to Bruce Wayne, in a sense, to L. So go out and check these things out because they're really worth it. And I'm kind of arcing in a slow way towards watching more Japanese and other Asian media at the moment. I've kind of gone off American stuff to a certain extent. And I'm heading northwest from here, east to most of the people in the world. I'm not sure what people call it, the Far East, particularly in America, when the fact is it's pretty much the Far West for most Americans. Nonetheless, I'm going to have to dive into more things like this because it really is a lot of fun. I do have the Lone Wolf and Cub box set, which I should really dip into and have a go at very, very soon. But anyway, that's about it for this time around. It's been a lot of fun. These two, well, actually three movies were enjoyable and unexpected to me. They gave me plot twists I didn't expect and anticipate and took me to really interesting and fun places and expanded my horizons, particularly when it comes to the Death Notes. So anyway, I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to re-record now the credits because the credits need to be updated and I will put them in after this bit. So thank you very much for listening. I will be back next week with another Paleo Cinema podcast, in 2 weeks with another Martian Driving podcast. Take care of yourselves. Be cool. Keep watching the skies and I'll be back very soon. But stick around for the credits because I've re-recorded them. And here are the credits. Thank you to Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris our Music Director, Jan our Dialect Coach, Armin our Key Grip, Matt our Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine our Scientific Advisor, Julia our Casting Director, Chris the Camera Operator, Christopher the Gaffer, Miss Jane the Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy our Foley Artist, Alyssa our Location Scout, Mark our Set and Unit Director, Paul our Special Makeup Effects Director, Tammy our Donut Wrangler, Tim our New York Unit Director, Rabbi Steve our Spiritual Advisor, Steve our Monster Effects Guy, Dylan our Goat Wrangler, Eric our Set Security Lead, Richard H. the Set Photographer, Mark D. Extra, David L. the Extra, Richard C. our Transportation Co-Captain, Carrie L. our Tasmanian Consultant, and Kerry C. our Accountant. We also have Sally, our Continuity Girl, and of course the other Sally, who is always helpful and encouraging and wonderful. So thank you very much to all of the Patreon subscribers. You too can be a Patreon subscriber by going to patreon.com/paleocinema and donating as little as $1 per month.